Primal theory in a sphere, and I'm going to try to study it and search for hints of stringy behavior in this thermodynamics. And we will find the stringy behavior. Okay. Before proceeding, I have to distribute credit. And okay. So a lot of what I'm going to say, maybe 70% of what I'm going to say, is contained in a paper by Bo Sundberg, written about 3 years ago. Bo Sundberg is a Swedish string theorist at Stockholm. Okay, so that's the distribution. That's as far as credit is concerned. I'll tell you a bit of history as well, in case you're interested. I mean, part of the reason why I'm talking about it is that about a month ago, Ofa Aharoni, Mark Van Ransdonk, my student Joseph Marsano, and I, we started studying this problem, and we worked it all out. And a few days before putting out what we thought would be our paper, we realized Bo Sundberg had done a lot of it. Okay, so... okay. So the credit is Bo Sundberg. This is why I'm talking about it. Okay. Okay. Also, there are things that I'm saying that are not in Sundberg's paper. Eventually, I hope we'll have many more. But okay. Good. So let me start. So I'm okay. So we're interested in trying to understand the thermodynamics of free angles theory on a sphere. Now, the first question is, why is this problem not trivial? You know, if we try to understand the thermodynamics of U1 Yang-Mills theory on a sphere, this problem is rather simple. Right? I mean, maybe there's some calculational difficulty in finding the exact function, but there's no mystery in the qualitative behavior of the thermodynamics. It's not terribly interesting. Okay, the SUN, or U1 Yang-Mills theory, is much more interesting because for the following reason. We are really interested in Yang-Mills theory in the limit G goes to 0. And in that limit, we're allowed to ignore almost all interactions in the theory except one. That interaction is the interaction that enforces the Gauss law constraint. You see, that interaction is extremely important because it tells you that at any coupling, no matter how small, the only states that you're allowed to retain in your theory are singlets, are SUN singlets on the sphere. I want to remind you that this is not true in R4. You know, the electron is an allowed state in QED on R4. It satisfies the Gauss law by being a source of flux, which then goes off to infinity. However, the electron is not an allowed state on the sphere. Okay? If it tries to source flux, the flux has nowhere to end. Okay? But an electron-positron pair is an allowed state on the sphere. Okay? And processing the same logic carefully for gauge theories, you find that all the allowed states on the sphere, at all coupling, and in particular in the limit G goes to 0, are SUN singlets on the sphere. Okay? So for this reason, the thermodynamics of SUN Yang-Mills theory is not the same as the thermodynamics of U1 to the n squared Yang-Mills theory on the sphere, even when the coupling is arbitrarily small. Okay? So in my study, I'm going to retain only this one effect of interaction, namely cutting down the spectrum of Yang-Mills theory from all gluons to singlets. Okay, and we'll see that this interaction is already enough to give interesting behavior. In particular, we'll see by the end of this talk that this interaction is at large n, the theory will have two phases. A sharp phase transition between a low temperature and a high temperature phase. The low temperature phase will be conceptually a confining phase. The high temperature phase will be conceptually a deconfining phase. There'll be a sharp phase transition between these two phases. The sharp phase transition will turn out to be a Hagedorn transition. So very reminiscent of stringy behavior, and we'll discuss all of this much more. Okay, so this is the general outline of what I'm going to do. Questions or comments? Objections. Okay, good. Okay, so let me start. So first, what we want to do is to study the thermodynamics of Yang-Mills theory on the sphere. So let's see, all of this is generalizable to higher dimensions and lower dimensions. But to be specific, in this talk, I'll concentrate on four-dimensional Yang-Mills on an S3. Okay, and In order to set up this study, I'm going to first discuss some preliminary things that we'll soon need. So, following Sundberg and Polyakov, I'm going to first define what I call a partition function for latents. So you remember what? Okay. So the way I'm going to first present this thermodynamics is by counting all the gauge invariant states of a given energy of the sphere. But by the state operator, you know, when I say Yangmills on a sphere, I mean Yangmills conformally coupled on the sphere, you know, with the r phi squared terms if you have scalars and so on. Okay. And so that's what I'm interested in because of ADS CFT. Okay. So we know that there is a slightly simpler way than counting states on the sphere. That slightly simpler way uses the state operator correspondence. So remember, for every state on the sphere, there's an operator of the theory on R4. And the energy of the theory on S3 maps to the dimension of the operator on R4. Okay? So I'll be interested in counting operators, singlet operators in the R4 theory. Okay? And the singlet condition in the first part of what I'm doing will simply be enforced by ensuring that all the operators we consider are products of traces. Okay, so let me get to that. So, but before I get to that, I have to set up some preliminary. So I define f of x, this is, as far as I know, this is Polyakov's terminology. It's a partition function for letters. So this is what it means. You know, suppose that there was a scalar field. A scalar field in the problem, an adjoint scalar field. I'm interested in counting all operators that you can make from this adjoint scalar field of dimension delta. So let's start listing these operators. Well, there's phi, then there's del mu phi, then there's del mu phi, and so on. Okay, but once we get to this level, we have to be a little careful because operators that are zero by equations of motion don't correspond to any state on the S3, and so should be counted as zero. So we have to count these operators up to the equation of motion. The equation of motion of this free Yangmills theory is del square phi is equal to zero. Okay? So here there's one state. Here there's four states. And here you might think there was 10. That's 4 and 5 by 2. But that's minus 1, minus del square, which is zero by the equation of motion. So 9. And maybe you see the pattern. It turns out if you do this counting, if you think about it, there's the number of states at dimension k is k squared. Okay. So f of x is defined as follows. It's the number of states of dimension delta times x to the power delta, sum over all delta. Okay? In this particular case, with a single scalar adjoint field, this would simply be sum over k. So f of x would be sum over k, k squared, x to the power k. Okay? And this is a sum that can be evaluated and turns out to be x plus x squared over minus x, so it's a cube. Okay, so this is a partition function. This is what its definition is. And the information in this is the number of sort of adjoint operators at dimension k. The coefficient of x to the power k contains that information. Is that clear? Is it clear what its object is? Okay, so this is the partition function for the scalar fields. We can similarly do the same thing for the vector field and for fermions. The counting is not difficult to do, but I don't have the time to go through all of it with you. So this I can call, let's say, fs of x. There'll be some f vector of x and some f fermion of x.
Wait, sorry, Charles, is there a reason you're not considering products of
phi? I'm going to take that into account very soon. So this is of single objects. I'm going to make traces of products of these guys in a moment.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so these are what Polyakov calls letters. We're going to then take these letters and make products of them and take traces, and these traces are called words. So we'll eventually count words. Okay, good. Fine. So, other thing I want you to notice about this function f of x is, now we've been weighting things with x to the power k. In thermodynamics, we really want to weight things with e to the power minus beta times dimension. Okay? So where we actually use these f of x's, x will have the interpretation of e to the power minus beta, where beta is 1 over temperature. Okay? I'll often write x instead of e to the power minus beta because it saves the writing. But that's what it is. Okay? Good. So now I want to examine the behavior of this f of x as x varies between as temperature varies from zero to infinity. So when the temperature is zero, x is zero. When the temperature is infinity, x is one. So I want to examine the behavior of f of x between zero and one. And you see that it's an always increasing function that starts off at zero and goes to infinity at one. Okay? This is true of this f of x for the scalar, but it turns out to be true for the vector f of x, the fermion f of x as well. The full f of my theory is going to be the sum of all the constituent f's. So this sum has this property. Some increasing function that increases from 0 to infinity as x goes from 0 to 1. Okay, good. Now the next thing I want to do is start counting the singlet operators of the theory.
Sorry, is this sort of the partition function, wouldn't you get a product of contribution?
Coming up.
Okay.
Yes, this is just the partition function for single letters. I'm soon going to be counting this.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry,
I keep having No, that's good. Okay, good. So now the next thing I want to do is to find a partition function for words. Okay? For these traces of these letters. Okay. So these are what are going to map to physical states. And eventually, traces and products of traces are going to be all the physical states in the problem. Okay. So how do we find this partition function for words? Now, there's a way of doing this problem exactly in terms of the letter partition function using a very nice combinatorial theorem by a guy called Polya, many of you know, I'm sure. It's a beautiful problem. Polya's counting is a beautiful thing, and I wish we had the time to go through it. But since we don't, I'm going to roughly give you some rough intuition for what the answer is before stating the answer. Okay, so see, suppose we wanted to make a word which is made up of k letters. Okay. If we want to make a... For the moment, let me ignore the fact, ignore an important point in this problem, which is that operators are equal, that operators have cyclical symmetry. So trace of AABB, for instance, is not different from trace of BAAB. This is just the same operator. But let me ignore that for the moment. Okay. If I ignore the cyclical property, then okay... the partition function of words of length k would simply be the partition function. Well, you have to choose one letter at each of the slots. Okay? So the partition functions would just multiply, okay? And we'd get just f of x to the power k. Okay. Now this is too crude. Okay? So we're overcounting by a lot because we're counting operators that are actually the same as being different. How much are we overcounting by? Roughly speaking, well, if we were looking at operators in which all these were different elements, A, B, C, D, then we've overcounted by a factor of k. Because each cyclical thing is different. Okay? So you might think this is the right answer, but that's undercounting. Because there are some operators like A, to which cyclicity imposes no restriction. Okay? So this is a lower bound, and this is an upper bound to the problem. So it's somewhere between this answer and this answer. Okay. So let me just work with this answer, which actually turns out contains all the physics. And then I'll tell you what the right answer is when you do it exactly. Okay. So suppose we had this answer, and we summed it over k. That's an easy sum to do, and we find it's minus log of 1 minus f of x. Okay? So now just to make you happy, let me tell you the full answer. The full answer, this will contain all the physics. So if you've understood the derivation, the quote-unquote derivation of this, you should be happy. But the full answer, which you can do using some fancy combinatorics, very beautiful combinatorics actually, turns out to be minus where phi of m runs from 1 to infinity. And phi of m is the number of integers smaller than m and relatively prime to m. Okay? So this turns out to be the partition function for these single words. Okay? You don't need to bother about most of the details of this thing. And actually, by the end of the talk, I'll have given you an independent derivation using physics rather than combinatorics. So, not the same answer. Okay, good.
It can't be independent.
What?
It can't be independent.
Well, okay, nothing is independent in the end.
Different.
Much nicer, let me say. Okay. So that's good. This is what this partition function looks like. But now, notice that this f here goes from 0 to infinity as x goes from 0 to 1. So now you see that there's a problem. There's a point, there's some critical x, somewhere between 0 and 1, so some critical temperature at which the partition function blows up. Okay, what does that mean? Now you can perform an honest analysis to see what this means, but let me just convince you of the answer. Let me remind you that there are other situations in which we see partition functions blowing up, and in particular, exactly this form of the blow up occurs when you have a density of states in your problem, so this rho of e is equal to e to the power minus beta subconstant, which I'll call beta h, stands for Hagedorn, times e divided by e. Okay? Okay. When you try to solve the thermodynamics with such a density of states, you find that z of beta is equal to e to the power minus beta, let's say minus beta h, e divided by e. Okay, this clearly makes no sense for temperatures higher than 1 over beta h, or betas lower than beta h. Okay, but let's look at how it approaches this point of divergence. Okay, when this thing is still positive but small, well, if we didn't have this, we'd get a logarithmic divergence. If we have it, this thing cuts off that logarithmic divergence. So this is roughly of order v minus beta h. Okay? So such a density of states would give you this kind of divergence as beta tends to beta h. It may not be so transparent here in terms of all these x's, but you see this log and you get exactly the same kind of divergence in this problem. Okay? So this partition function contains the information that the density of states blows up in this manner and is actually Hagedorn-like. Okay, now let me quickly tell you why the full answer doesn't change any of these conclusions. As you see, the full answer contains an infinite sum of terms of log of 1 minus f of x to the m. But when x is between 0 and 1, x to the m is smaller than x. Okay, so suppose x is at this point where f of x is equal to 1, x to the m for any m is somewhere here. So f of x to the m is smaller than 1. This whole thing is regular for those guys, and so it's uninteresting near the interesting part of the spectrum, namely where this blow up happens. Okay, so all the interesting information is contained just here. Okay, so we've come to the conclusion that that this problem seems to have in it a Hagedorn density of states. Okay. Questions or comments before I proceed?
How dimension dependent is your conclusion?
It's not dimension dependent at all. It works in every dimension. Right, that's an odd feature of this. It works even in quantum mechanics with matrices projecting to ciliates. Right. Right at the end, I'll have some comments on how I expect four dimension speed. But at the moment, okay. Now you might. I've got all this.
Is the normal Hagedorn temperature is at the string scale? Right?
Yes.
What's playing the role of that scale here?
Okay. Good. So that's a good question. We've been working on a sphere of radius 1. Okay. If we'd worked on a sphere of radius r, we would have found a Hagedorn temp. So we're getting a Hagedorn temperature of order 1, but that order 1 is in units of the radius. In units of 1 over the radius of the sphere. Okay, so it's the size of the space that's determining your... okay. And by the end, if I have time, I'll tell you how this ties up with ADS here, what this means in terms of ADS here. Okay. Good. So now, I've done something a little strange, right? I mean, I've taken a Yang-Mills theory, and I've not said too much. I've come to the conclusion that it has this huge infinite density of states. But Yang-Mills theory is a field theory. It doesn't have a huge infinite density of states. So I must have done something wrong. And actually, without telling you about it, I've secretly been working at n equals infinity. The place that I've used n equals infinity is the following place. You see, when you have object, suppose we had a 2 cross 2. Suppose we had a single 2 cross 2 Hermitian matrix M. I'll remind you of a nice simple identity concerning 2 cross 2 matrices. I think. Okay, this is an identity for any 2 cross 2 Hermitian matrix M that you can check by writing this as lambda 1 cube plus lambda 2 cube, where lambda 1 and lambda 2 are its two eigenvalues. This as, you know what I mean. Okay? It's just, you know, the two quantities. And so this is an identity. So if we had been working in SU2 Yang-Mills theory, you already see that we would have been doing something really stupid. You know, the way I did the counting, I counted all traces of operators as independent operators. But you see that once we get to operators of size n, and actually it's really n squared that will turn out to be more relevant for reasons I won't describe now. Once you get to operators where the trace has n squared elements in it, okay, you have to start worrying because these operators are not all independent, and you shouldn't count as if they count independent states. Okay? So everything I've said is correct. As long as I'm looking at densities of states in which we're multiplying less than n squared adjoint elements together. But when we start multiplying n squared or more, this thing is just wrong, and I have to do something else. Okay, is that clear? Questions, comments?
I mean, this is a hard problem for finite n, to get the exact answer.
Yes, it's true. It's a hard problem.
Do you have the answer for finite n?
No, we have, but there's an interesting high temperature behavior even at infinite n, and we can see the first corrections. So let me continue. Exactly. So the problem for finite n is actually difficult. Okay, but let's say we stick to n goes to infinity. Okay, we're in the infinite n limit. We already see here that a temperature of order 1, not a temperature that goes to infinity yet as n goes to infinity, but a temperature of order 1, we have this Hagedorn phase transition. Okay. So what happens to the system? It's some quantum field theory. Okay, what happens to the system at higher temperatures? What happens, suppose that the Hagedorn transition had happened at temperature 1, what's the behavior of the system at temperature 2? That should have an answer. So I'm now going to try to tell you what the answer is. Okay, so in order to tell you that answer, I'm going to make another approximation. I'll do it again crudely and then tell you the full answer, like we did here. Okay. You see, once we're at high enough temperature so that there are so many that a typical state has more than n squared elements, it's just a bad way to think of the problem to think in terms of traces. Okay, this, if you think of each trace as a particle, these particles start interacting very, very strongly. So it's not a non-interacting problem anymore. Okay, so it's just a bad way to think of the problem in terms of traces. So you want another way of thinking of it. Okay, and this other way works. Okay, so let me again work in an approximation. Suppose I were to try to count the number of states, in which I had k different kinds of photons acting on the vacuum, or an operator with k different adjoint fields. Okay, if I was doing this counting in the U1 theory, and if I ignored states, you know, if for some reason, and I'll tell you whether this is valid, the states in which you have repetitions, you have the same photon appearing twice, okay? If those are sort of negligible, then the counting is rather easy to do. In the U1 theory, you find f of x to the power k divided by k factorial. The k factorial is from the fact that all these particles are identical. Okay? This is not completely correct when we have repetitions, but without that, this is okay. Now, in the real UN Yang-Mills theory, if we look at all the states that come from k k different photons, but each of these is an adjoint field, and we want to multiply this by the number of ways of making singlets out of these k adjoint fields. Okay? Now, how do we do that counting? Actually, that's some very simple group theory tells you how to do that counting, so let me review it for you. Remember that there's this object that mathematicians call the character of a trace. Okay? A character of a group element, which is simply the trace of that group element in a particular representation. Okay? So it's a number that comes from that given a group element and a representation, you get a number. That's the character. Okay. Now this character has this nice property that if you take the tensor product of representations, okay, then the character on that tensor product of representation is simply this product of the characters on each of the two representations. This is a property of tensor products of matrices and traces. Okay? The character has one other nice property, that of orthogonality. If you take the character corresponding to some representation, okay, it's corresponding to an irreducible representation, multiply it by the conjugate character corresponding to another irreducible representation and integrate over the group manifold, you get 0 unless the two representations are the same, and with the right normalization you get 1 otherwise. Okay? So, what we wanted to do was to find the number of singlets in the product of k adjoints. So I'm going to do this using characters. Firstly, I'm going to say, well, the product of k adjoints has a character which is chi. Okay, so let me call trace adjoint of u to the power k. That was the first property of characters that I reminded you of. The next thing I want to do is count how many singlets there are here. So all I have to do in order to get that is to multiply by the character of the singlet, but that's 1, okay, and integrate over the group. So that counts the number of singlets in this product. Okay, so that's nice. So all we have to do is multiply this by the u trace in the adjoint of u to the u the whole thing to the power k. Okay, this is when we have k photons. The right answer sums k from 0 to infinity, so it's that object. Okay, so this is simply exponential of integral du exponential of f of x trace in the adjoint of u. Okay? And in order to study this problem, I use another simple fact about un. The trace in the adjoint of u is simply the trace in the fundamental times the trace in the anti-fundamental of u, because the adjoint in un is basically a quark, an anti-quark. Okay? So we can rewrite this as an integral over unitary matrices, n cross n matrices. Here it was an abstract integral over the group volume. Now I write this as an integral over unitary matrices of exponential of f of x trace u diagonal. Okay? So this object here is an approximation to a partition function. Okay. Now, I know many people here don't like approximations, so you can do this whole problem exactly. Again, I don't have the time to do it. This is just some counting problem. And I mean, okay, it takes some doing, but it can be done. And this is the full answer. As you saw in the other counting problem, we got, you know, the naive approximation had a term with just f of x, then it was connected with terms with f of x to the power m. The same thing happens here. Okay. I'm not going to try to justify this for you, but I claim that this is the exact answer for this partition function. Okay, I'm now going to try to study the physics of this answer, but before that, of course, questions or comments. So now that we've rewritten this partition function as a matrix model, we can try to solve this matrix model. Okay? We're not trying to solve the whole matrix problem,
which is a bit of a job.
Well, it's always good to start with a simple problem. So let's try to solve this simple, the matrix model that we could derive in 2 minutes before trying to do the whole thing. Okay? So I'm going to start trying to solve this problem.
Wait,
yes.
Yeah, I know you already answered this, but how come it doesn't depend on dimensions? And you think you have more modes of the fields and different dimensions?
So f of x depends on dimension.
Oh, okay.
You see, I calculated f of x. I gave you an example for a scalar field in 4 dimensions.
Oh, okay.
But, yes. Okay. Good. It also depends on the matter content. You know, everything that I've been doing works with any number of fields in the adjoint. You just add up the f of x's for each letter. Okay? Good. So now I'm going to try to take you through a quick solution of that matrix model. This is something everyone is familiar with, especially over the last year, everyone's really geared up on matrix models, right? So we can solve matrix models too. So of course we want to do this in the large n limit. So in the large n limit, this matrix model is dominated by a saddle point. Okay, just before trying to solve it, just to check that it's a well posed problem. Notice that the energy here scales like n squared because there are 2 traces. The entropy also scales like n squared, but it's 2 integral over n squared elements. So entropy and energy compete with each other. So it's a well posed problem. There's interesting physics in this problem. It's not free, it's not dominated by... Okay, so in the large n limit, so actually, which blackboard is easier for people to see, that one or that one? Okay, yeah. Okay, so in the large n limit, this thing is dominated by a saddle point. Okay, so let's see how we do this integral. Firstly, the integral over matrices can be turned into an integral over eigenvalues. Where the eigenvalues of a unitary matrix, of course, take the form e to the power I alpha I. So these are the phases of the eigenvalues. Times a measure factor, which is quite well known. Look up in classic papers. So I've just done a change of variables. Okay? And then we've got that exponential of... Now, I'm going to suppress the dependence on x in what follows. Remember, when I write f, it's f of x. F of sum over the eigenvalues, e to the power I alpha I, sum over I, sum over e to the power minus I alpha. Okay? Now, the next step is to take this measure factor up into the exponential. So this is product over I, this is I and j. No, it's just I. Sorry. Okay, yeah, here I and j. Exponential of sum I not equal to j, log of sine alpha I minus alpha j divided by 2. That was the measure factor. And then plus trace... Now we're going, both terms here are order n squared, n is large, dominated by saddle point. Let's calculate the saddle point. To calculate the saddle point, we differentiate with respect to each of these eigenvalues and set that differential to 0. So differentiating with respect to this, we get log of cot. Okay. I'm not keeping track of factors of 2 in. if we do the same thing here, okay. So now I'm going to make an assumption, which will be self-consistently justified by the answer, one particular branch of the answer. Okay, we'll see what status of this assumption is fine. Okay, the assumption is that the eigenvalue distribution is symmetric around 0. Okay, you'll see what the status of that is. Okay, so then this sum over i's is sum over cosines. Okay, so what we get here is, there was an f. So f times b times sine alpha i, alpha j, alpha i, And here we've got a sample where biology. B here is simply the sum over cosines. Over all the eigenvalues. And so the way I'm going to solve this equation is by treating this B as a constant, solving for B, solving for the eigenvalue distribution, and then later self-consistently determining B from the solution. Okay. So now I've written this in terms of eigenvalues, but of course we want to really write this in terms of a density of eigenvalues. Okay. So suppose I've got some rho of alpha, then this summation, let me call this B prime. So we'll call B, which is B prime by N, which is rho of alpha cos alpha. And this summation will turn into an integral. There'll be a factor of N which cancels. So we want to solve the equation rho of alpha cot of alpha minus beta by 2 is equal to F times B sine of beta. That's the equation we want to solve. Okay? But now we're in luck, because Gross and Witten solved this equation 25 years ago. Okay? They were solving a very similar problem. It's not exactly the same, it's very similar. The final equation they got for the eigenvalues is exactly this. Okay? So, then we can just look up the Gross-Witten solution and read off the eigenvalue distribution. Okay? And this is the answer. You get rho. Okay, Gross and Witten defined a quantity lambda, which I'll do the same because it might be familiar to some people. So, F times B is going to be equal to 1 over lambda, just to make contact with the Gross-Witten formula. Okay? And Gross-Witten found that rho of x, rho of alpha, as we call it, is equal to 1 over 2 pi, 1 plus 2 by lambda cos alpha, for lambda greater than or equal to 2, and is equal to where in lambda less than or equal to 2, this rho has support not over the whole circle, but only where this thing makes sense. See, where alpha is some parameter in the solution, which can be solved for in terms of lambda by requiring that this integrate to 1. Okay? And lambda varies between sine squared alpha, minus sine alpha and plus sine alpha. Okay, so is this answer clear? Good. So now we have one more step to do. After having solved for this, after having used their solution, we now have still to self-consistently determine our B. Okay? So using this solution, now we can find what the expectation value of cos of alpha. Oh, God, I've used. I'm sorry. So this should be rho of lambda. I'm sorry for that mix up. Alpha here is a constant parameter. And, lambda is a parameter as well, I'm sorry. Let me call this x.
Well, that's alpha, right?
Here, this is...
You're looking for distribution of alpha.
Yeah, just let me check. Wait, there are two things. I think this was the concept. I think this is right. It's something like this. Sorry. actually, I have. Okay. I'll look. Yeah. Okay. So this is right. Okay. So x here is the variable. Okay. And it doesn't go through its full range because it only goes through sine squared x. You know, when sine x is smaller between lambda by 2 and Okay, sorry, I messed up somewhere here. There's a formula even right there. I'm sorry I messed this up. Okay, this factor of 2 is wrong, right, Mark?
Can we just destroy it?
Okay. So, right. So the eigenvalue distribution on the circle here for lambda greater than 2 is non-zero everywhere in the circle. And the eigenvalue distribution for lambda less than 2 is non-zero, let's say, here. I've centered it around 0, so it's here. Okay? So it's non-zero from here to here. This point varies depending on what lambda is. When lambda goes to 0, the eigenvalue distribution crunches up, bang to the identity. Why is that? You know, that's actually the limit in which this potential term, remember, lambda is inversely related to f. So it's the limit in which this potential term gets very big. Okay? This is like an entropy versus energy. When the energy gets very big, all the eigenvalues sit where they minimize the energy, near the identity. Okay? The entropy tries to spread them out, and that's this business. Once lambda gets large enough, the entropy is enough to spread it out around the whole circle. That's when you get this phase transition. Okay. So sorry for that, but is that clear? Okay. Good. So now the next thing you can do is self-consist, take this eigenvalue distribution and on it evaluate B, expectation value of cosine of the eigenvalues. Okay? And then say that, okay, this thing, whatever it is, must be equal to B, which went into our formula here. That gives you an equation that allows you to solve for B. Okay? And the equation the equation takes actually two different forms. In the phase lambda greater than or equal to 2, that eigenvalue distribution, you get the equation f times b is equal to b. In the phase lambda less than or equal to 2, you get a more interesting equation. You get the equation then you have to substitute that lambda was equal to 1 over fb. It's a quadratic equation, which you can then solve. Okay, so let's look at these solutions. This equation you can just solve, and you get a nice self-consistent equation. You get a nice self-consistent solution, okay? Provided that you get a nice self-consistent solution, which I'll write down for you. You get 1 over b is equal to 2 times... Okay, and this is a nice, meaningful solution, provided that f is larger than 1. Okay, so when f is larger than 1, we have the solution here, which is the small lambda phase of gross width. This equation, of course, is much more trivial. Okay, it has two solutions: f equals 1 or b equals 0. When f is equal to 1, you know, f is a parameter, it's changing, that's not in our hands. When f is equal to 1, this solution, that corresponds actually to lambda equals 2. So this phase transition point in this eigenvalue distribution. And we just recover the solution that we got from this phase at lambda equals 2. So you get nothing new. Okay? So the interesting, the other interesting solution is b equals 0. Okay? And actually, that solution, if you think about it, corresponds to a completely uniform distribution of eigenvalues over the circle. Okay, so I'm now going to, I've gone through this very fast and with one formula that I couldn't quite get right. So I'm now going to just quickly summarize for you. So what has all this taught us? Okay. So this is the net conclusion. When f of x is less than 1, there's a unique saddle point. That saddle point corresponds to rho of alpha equals 1 over 2 pi, which is the constant. Okay? When f of x is greater than 1, okay, we have a non-trivial saddle point like that, okay, which takes that form where lambda is given in terms of f by solving all these equations. Okay, if you plot the free energy of this, if you plot the free energy of this solution divided by n squared, so that is log of partition function divided by n squared. And if you want, you can multiply this by temperature to get minus temperature to find the free energy. This is what it looks like. The free energy is zero until you hit the temperature at which f of x equals 1, and then it starts smoothly going down to some negative quantity. Okay? F of x equals 1 is a phase transition point in this matrix model. The phase transition here happens to be first order, unlike Gross-Witten where it's third order. It's unlike Gross-Witten because we don't have the same, we never implement this solution. There's a jump to something else. Okay? But if you remember the first part of my talk, it's very nice that the phase transition happens not at some arbitrary point, but exactly where f of x equals 1. You remember from the counting of traces, we saw that there was a blow-up of the partition function, a Hagedorn blow-up of the partition function, exactly at f of x equals 1. Okay? So this matrix model is seeing this Hagedorn transition.
Sorry, I thought that what you just said was at the step where you hadn't done all of this.
Yes, but this is just exact.
Okay. Right, okay. So this didn't change? You could have just stopped there?
Could have stopped where?
No, I'm just not understanding the logic.
Good. let me spell it out.
Okay, what I'm confused about is that upper left corner.
Yes.
Where I thought at that point you'd already identified the Hagedorn transition.
Yes. But we could say nothing about, let's say, we could say nothing about the high energy behavior. Okay? Mm-hmm. The high temperature behavior. We understood the thermodynamics at low temperatures, okay, and then the thermodynamics seem to blow up, okay, and that's where our ability to calculate stopped, okay, and the reason it stopped is that our approximation of counting each single trace became bad. Each single trace as independent became bad.
Oh, it was good below that.
It was good below that because you could check that it was good below that because below that we always the free energy was finite, okay. As long as the free energy is finite, that meant finite number of adjoints are, a typical state has a finite number of adjoints, okay? So then this approximation of all single traces being independent is very good for the states you're counting, okay? But you see here that the free energy at the high temperature phase is of order n square, okay? So this counting is very bad in the high temperature phase. Now the matrix model I presented to you is just completely exact, okay? So, the matrix model I solved has this approximation because I've restricted just one of these things. But I'm soon going to tell you what happens. Okay, with the matrix model, the full exact matrix model, which you can just solve. So it reproduces both the low temperature and the high temperature. Good.
The low are you saying that the low temperature regime is the zero there?
The low temperature regime is these. Is the B equals zero?
No,
yes.
Is this zero? So is this because here you said that it's something different.
Good. That's a good point. I should have made that clear. You see, what we are computing here is the leading order in the n expansion. Okay? So the saddle point tells us about the behavior of the part of the free energy that scales like n square. Okay? The free energy that I computed to you in the first part of my talk was of order 1. Okay, so that is the first 1 over n squared correction to this 0. Okay, so in fact, somebody should give me a hard deadline. so who's Andreas?
I'm supposed to get my 10 more minutes.
Fantastic. Okay, let me now quickly sort of convince you that we could recover the old counting from this matrix model. Before that, let me just quickly tell you why this is qualitatively correct, even for the full matrix model, without making this approximation. You see, at the phase transition point, this rho of x has a very nice property. The rho of x has this property that if you Fourier expand it in cosines, okay, it only has cosine of 1 times x. It doesn't have any cosine 2 times x or cosine 3 times x components. Okay? So that tells you that while trace U has some expectation value in this model, trace U squared or trace U cubed and so on are all zero at the phase transition point. Okay? So, but all our corrections to the matrix model, okay, were quadratic in trace U to some higher power. Okay? So if you think about that, that tells you that this at the phase transition point, at f of x equals 1, this is an exact solution to the saddle point of the full matrix model. You know, you get corrections to the equations of the saddle point equations of motion, but evaluated on this, those corrections all evaluate to 0. Okay? This is very important because, you know, we'd seen before that the Hagedorn transition happened exactly at f of x equals 1. We would have wanted it to shift around a little bit, and it doesn't. Is this point clear? Okay? So though we've calculated this, though we've found this solution for this truncated matrix model, now you can now check that it is actually a solution at f of x equals 1, the Hagedorn temperature, it's actually a valid solution to the full matrix model. Okay? Because nobody's looking happy at this. Yes?
So how do you know it approaches it in that way? Did you just say that the values are the same?
I said that, you know, you're solving some eigenvalue equation. This is an exact solution. This is an exact solution to the saddle point equations, so long as f of x is equal to 1.
So the values agree.
The values of what?
I don't know.
see, this is the logic. We've got some parameters that define our matrix model. That's the parameters are f of x. We want to find the saddle point given the values of these parameters. Now, if you don't like the way I've derived it, you can forget about that. I'm going to tell you, try this out when f of x is equal to 1, and you'll find that it solves the saddle point equations at f of x equals 1. Okay? And the reason for that is that, the corrections are all quadratic. Corrections are all quadratic or higher order in trace u to the power n. But each of trace u to the power n evaluates to 0 on this distribution. So you get corrections to the equations of motion, but they evaluate to 0 on this solution. Is that clear? Now, this is true only at the phase transition point. When we move away from the phase transition point, indeed, this eigenvalue distribution will be corrected. Okay? But this eigenvalue distribution correctly, but of course, this correction is small when you move infinitesimally away. So this captures correctly the properties of the phase transition.
So the curve is a good curve
in the neighborhood of that curve, yes.
In the neighborhood of the phase transition?
Of the phase transition.
And then hopefully taking into account all these corrections, you would recover behavior that you advertised in the first part.
Okay, so let me show you how we get that.
But is it true or not?
It's true. Yeah, okay. It's true. And let me quickly show you how you get that. Now, the way we want to get the behavior that I talked about in the first part, okay, is by evaluating the 1 over n squared corrections, okay, evaluating the 1 over n squared corrections to this partition function. So it's doing a one-loop integral around the saddle point. Okay? But that's pretty easy to do around this uniform distribution of eigenvalues. You see, what we want to do... What we want to do is, roughly speaking, a path integral over the density matrix, the eigenvalue density function, d rho, of exponential of rho of x, rho of y, log of sine x minus y by 2, plus sum over n, f of... Okay? So, we've already evaluated what this is on the saddle point, where this is uniform, it's just zero. Okay? Now we want to do the one-loop correction. But this is a quadratic path integral, which we can do. Okay? It's better than being quadratic, because sort of this is like position space on the circle. Everything depends only on differences between alpha minus beta. So by moving to momentum space, okay, this thing diagonalizes mode by mode. You can do the quadratic path integral, and you recover exactly the formula I wrote.
that one you mentioned? So you, yeah. You see that near the critical...
Yeah.
You see the...
Exactly. You see that there's a zero mass mode near the critical point. Yeah, you see everything. See that... You know, you in fact even see the tachyon of the Hagedorn transition. Okay. Okay. I'm sorry, I don't have... Well, so let, in the last 5 minutes, I'm going to now try to stop doing this. I mean, it's technical stuff, and try to tell you about some physics. Okay. Firstly, I want to interpret this U. You see, we've got this nice matrix model that solves for the partition function of this theory in terms of this auxiliary matrix U, and that so far sounds unsatisfying because this U is just some auxiliary parameter. Surely it has some physical meaning. Secondly, a thoroughbred physicist might say, look, you want to calculate a partition function of Yang-Mills on the sphere, what you should be doing is calculating a path integral of Yang-Mills on S3 cross S1 and getting all these results, and all this counting is, well, I don't believe you, just show me my path integral. Okay, so we can do that. And that will also give us an interpretation of this U. So I won't have time to go through the algebra for you and wanted to leave it, but I won't have time to go through all the algebra. But let me just tell you the important point. The important point is this: suppose we take the vector field, like say the gauge field A mu of x as scalars and fermions and so on, and try to do the imagine starting to do the path integral of Yang-Mills on the sphere times S1. Okay. Now we're going to try to do this in the quadratic approximation, ignoring all couplings. However, there is one coupling in this theory that we're not allowed to ignore. And we see this from the fact, you know, when you integrate out things at quadratic order, when you integrate out things at quadratic order, that's fine. If you're trying to do the integral e to the power minus alpha x squared, you get 1 over square root alpha. And this is fine as long as alpha is not 0. Okay? But it's a bad idea to integrate things out at quadratic order if the coefficient of the thing you're integrating out is 0. So 0 modes might cause a problem. Okay. Now you can ask, are there any 0 modes in your problem? Well, you might think that the constant function for all scalar fields in the sphere is a 0 mode, but it's not, because it's conformally coupled scalar fields. So that's massive. Okay. Gauge fields in the sphere have no 0 modes. That's well known. Okay, but the A0 component of A, okay, on the sphere has a 0 mode. The constant on the sphere times the constant on the circle. So that guy you have to be very careful about. That you don't want to integrate out quadratically because its quadratic coefficient is 0.